Chapter 7 Watergate Revisited The CIA's War Against Nixon The Incident The Watergate burglars broke into the Democratic National Committee headquarters on June 17, 1972, were taken into custody by police, and discovered to have ties to the Nixon White House. The official word. President Nixon authorized the break-in, along with other dirty tricks, and then covered this up, leading to his resignation on August 9, 1974, before he could be impeached. My take? Nixon was involved in a power struggle with the CIA, trying to pry loose what their files contained on the Kennedy assassination. He was taken down by double agents who were actually working for the CIA, who intentionally got themselves caught. Many of the Watergate cast track back to who killed JFK. In a time of deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. George Orwell. At this point in my life, I guess the word astounding should not be used, because I've been astounded by so many other things. But it was astounding to realize that Richard Nixon could actually have been set up by some of the Watergate burglars, whose loyalty was really to the CIA. When you look at some of the data, you realize this possibility exists. Watergate was an attempt to get him out of the White House, because he was going where other powerful people didn't want him to tread. The official history, of course, is that the break-in on the night of June 17, 1972, into the Democratic National Committee headquarters at the Watergate complex, was simply the latest in a long line of dirty tricks authorized by President Nixon. It just happened to be the time that his henchmen got caught. Ultimately, Watergate came to refer to the many illicit activities and the cover-up that led to Nixon's resignation in August 1974. That's the basic storyline of Woodward and Bernstein in All the President's Men, and most other accounts. Nixon was the bad guy who got carried away with his thirst for power, and that's that. But maybe it's as Watergate burglar G. Gordon Liddy once said, "The official version of Watergate is as wrong as a Flat Earth Society pamphlet." Let's start with the fact that Nixon had been haunted by the specter of the Kennedys ever since losing the election to JFK in 1960. He even happened to be in Dallas on November 22, 1963, for a Pepsi-Cola bottlers convention. If Robert Kennedy hadn't been assassinated, he'd have been the likely Democratic contender against Nixon in 1968, and quite likely Nixon would have lost. So what if after his election, his obsession resulted in the beginning of a carefully orchestrated plan to get rid of Nixon? What if it all tracked back to the assassination of John F. Kennedy almost a decade earlier? What if the Watergate backstory is really about what Nixon knew, or wanted to know, about who killed JFK? Maybe Nixon was determined to find out what the CIA possessed about the assassination, out of curiosity and for his own purposes. He could then use that knowledge against the powerful agency if he had to. Or maybe Nixon himself knew something about the assassination and was paranoid that the CIA might have the same secret knowledge. This knowledge could lead back to him, or people he knew. I'm not sure which it was, but I'll bet it was one or the other. And the CIA was determined to stop his quest. Let's start with the story that H.R. Haldeman, Nixon's chief of staff, related in his memoirs. Soon after taking office in 1969, the president called him into the Oval Office and officially asked Haldeman to get hold of any and all documents from the CIA that pertained to the Bay of Pigs. This was the first of many occasions that Nixon referred to that historical event, when the CIA sent an invasion force of Cuban exiles to try to overthrow Castro in April 1961. This plan had been in the works before JFK took office, and when it failed, Kennedy threatened to scatter the CIA to the four winds. Now that Nixon was president, why should he desire to learn everything he could about the whole Bay of Pigs thing, as he put it during one of his taped Oval Office conversations? Haldeman makes the startling assertion in his book that, in all of those Nixon references to the Bay of Pigs, he was actually referring to the Kennedy assassination. Around the middle of 69, Haldeman remembers Nixon domestic advisor John Ehrlichman dropping by to talk about Nixon's demand for CIA records. "Those bastards in Langley are holding back something," Ehrlichman said. "They just dig in their heels and say the president can't have it. Period. Imagine that. The commander-in-chief wants to see a document relating to a military operation, and the spooks say he can't have it. From the way they're protecting it, it must be pure dynamite." At the same time, CIA Director Richard Helms, who'd been in charge of clandestine ops when JFK was in power, was on his way over to the White House. Ehrlichman believed that the president is going to give him, Helms, a direct order. But after a long private conversation between Helms and Nixon, Ehrlichman said the president instructed him to forget all about that CIA document. In fact, I am to cease and desist from trying to obtain it. That little story is a volume-getter to me. First, it makes me wonder how much stonewalling takes place at the highest levels of government by subordinates. The CIA is supposedly the president's intelligence-gathering arm and answerable to him. What's gone wrong with our country when his guys are now keeping information from the boss? And what gives them the right to make that kind of command decision? I can understand in certain instances giving the boss plausible denial if you're doing something underhanded. But by the same token, people are going to question who's actually running the show. During these same early months of Nixon's presidency, the Howard Hughes empire was imploding in Las Vegas. Hughes had gotten billions in secret contracts from the CIA over the years and let his medical institute serve as one of their front companies. Hughes also gave Nixon, among other politicians, plenty of under-the-table funds. At the end of 1970, suddenly Hughes disappears. His top aide, Robert Mayhew, thinks the billionaire has been kidnapped. Mayhew gets forced off the Hughes Tool Company board, and he stashes a bunch of documents and tapes in the safe of his pal, Hank Greenspun, the editor of the Las Vegas Sun. What might have been in those documents and tapes? One of the Watergate burglars, James McCord, later said he'd been part of a plot to steal some stuff from Greenspun's safe. When the Senate Watergate Committee demanded that Greenspun show them those documents, the newsman got a court order to stop it. We still don't know what they contained, but one clue emerged in a column by Jack Anderson early in 1971 that tracked right back to the whole Bay of Pigs thing. Locked in the darkest recesses of the CIA is the story of six assassination attempts against Cuba's Fidel Castro, the article began. It went on to detail how Hughes's man Mayhew had teamed up with mobster Johnny Roselli to work with the CIA on a hush-hush murder mission. Anderson speculated that after the CIA mob plots supposedly stopped in the spring of 1963, Castro had sought revenge on JFK. This was the first time any details such as these had hit the news. Hughes had brought Roselli into his own organization when he moved into the mob's Las Vegas territory. Roselli was tight with Sam Giancana and Santos Traficante Jr., a couple of the gangsters who have since been linked to JFK's assassination. And a friend of Roselli's, Jimmy Starr, later told the mobster's biographers, "What I heard about the Kennedy assassination was that Johnny was the guy who got the team together to do the hit." We know today that certain people in the CIA wanted to pin the blame for JFK's murder on Castro to take the heat off themselves. We also know today that Nixon, while he was vice president under Eisenhower, was the liaison to the CIA in the first assassination attempt against Castro. But that secret, like the others, was still way below the radar when Nixon was in office. So on the very day that column by Jack Anderson came out, Haldeman asked John Dean, the White House counsel, to make an inquiry into the relationship between Mayhew, Hughes, and a guy named Lawrence O'Brien. Remember that name? It was O'Brien's office that the burglars broke into at the Watergate. At the time, he headed the Democratic National Committee, so people presumed Nixon's team were looking for dirt on the Dems. But O'Brien was not only a former staff assistant to the Kennedy brothers, but also an old friend of Robert Mayhew's. 2 weeks after Robert Kennedy's assassination, Mayhew had arranged for O'Brien to hire on as a consultant to the Hughes organization. Then, when Hughes vanished and Mayhew got purged, O'Brien went with him. As a White House aide wrote to John Dean on February 1, 1971, Mayhew's controversial activities and contacts in both Democratic and Republican circles suggest the possibility that forced embarrassment of O'Brien might well shake loose Republican skeletons from the closet. What kind of skeletons? Could the interest in O'Brien, all the way to the Watergate break-in, have concerned what he might know about Mayhew, Roselli, and the intrigue around the whole Bay of Pigs thing? In February 1971 came another Jack Anderson column about Roselli. The story was sketchy, but tantalizing. It said, "Confidential FBI files identify him as a top mafia figure who watched over the concealed interests in Las Vegas casinos of the Chicago underworld. Also that he'd been recruited by Mayhew and had handled undercover assignments for the CIA." The story concluded, "Roselli's lawyers are now trying to get clemency for their client, citing our stories about his secret CIA service." Sure looks like somebody was putting out a message through Anderson, doesn't it? Roselli was facing time and hinting he might squawk if he got convicted. So what happens next? Nixon's Attorney General John Mitchell phoned Mayhew, who caught the next flight to D.C., and told Mitchell everything he knew about the CIA mob plots. Mitchell was shaking by the time Mayhew ended his story, and after that helped Mayhew avoid a grand jury. What happens to Anderson after he does these stories? He's targeted by Nixon's infamous plumbers unit, the guys who like to plug leaks by breaking into various places. G. Gordon Liddy and E. Howard Hunt, Jr., later admitted during the Watergate hearings that they met with a CIA operative in 1972 to talk about slipping the columnist LSD, or putting poison in his aspirin bottle, or concocting a fatal mugging. The plot was aborted when the Watergate break-in occurred. Howard Hunt had supposedly retired from the CIA in April 1970, but he'd immediately landed a job with a CIA front outfit called the Mullen Company. They'd been instrumental in setting up the CIA's Cuban Freedom Committee that helped disseminate the Castro did it rumors after the Kennedy assassination. Their cover specialty was PR, and now they were representing the Hughes Tool Company. I am sure I need not explain the political implications of having Hughes's affairs handled here in Washington by a close friend, Nixon's hatchet man Charles Colson wrote in a memo. On the 10th anniversary of the Bay of Pigs in 1971, Hunt flew to Miami and got back in touch with two Cuban exiles he'd worked with during the anti-Castro battles of the early 60s. The exiles knew Hunt as Eduardo. Their names were Bernard Barker and Eugenio Martinez. Hunt took them along when he did a little private investigation, visiting a woman who claimed to have been in the Castro household with one of Fidel's sisters at the time that John Kennedy was assassinated. The woman said the reaction was one of moroseness because he, JFK, was dead. That may not have been what Hunt wanted to hear, but he said he sent reports to both the CIA and to the White House, although each denied ever getting such. Hunt said that after he went to work as a White House consultant in June 1971, he also kept his job with the Mullen Company, he kept a copy of his report in his safe there, only to see it destroyed after the Watergate break-in by the FBI. So I guess we'll never know what was really in it. Meantime, Hunt became chief operative of the Plumbers. As John Ehrlichman later described it, the unit, as originally conceived, was to stimulate the various departments and agencies to do a better job of controlling leaks and the theft or other exposure of national security secrets from within their departments. National security secrets, like who killed JFK, maybe? Early that same summer of 71, columnist Anderson met with Bernard Barker and another of Hunt's recruits, Frank Sturgis, in Miami. Anderson and Sturgis went back to 1960, when they collaborated on magazine articles about plans to overthrow Fidel Castro. Sturgis also knew a lot of secrets, including the CIA's formation of an assassination squad of Cuban exiles called Operation 40, just before the Bay of Pigs. After the Kennedy assassination, Sturgis had played a key role in spreading the rumors that Castro was behind it. Now Anderson was told the old crew was back in business with the legendary Eduardo E. Howard Hunt. But for whatever reason, the columnist wrote nothing about it. Things were happening thick and fast. Daniel Ellsberg leaked the Pentagon Papers to the media, secret policy documents about the Vietnam War buildup, and Nixon went ballistic. That's what first spawned the Plumbers, who mounted a covert op to break into the office of Ellsberg's psychiatrist, with assistance from the CIA's Office of Security. Except it wasn't only the Pentagon Papers that worried the CIA. Their concern, indeed what seems to have been their panic, focused around Ellsberg's friendship with Francis Fitzgerald, the talented author of Fire in the Lake, who was the daughter of the late Desmond Fitzgerald, a former deputy director of the CIA. The CIA saw his liberal daughter's friendship with Ellsberg as a threat and worried that it might lead to the exposure of operations that the CIA hoped would remain state secrets. We know today, but it wasn't public knowledge back then, that Desmond Fitzgerald, who died of a sudden heart attack on the tennis court in 1967, had ended up in charge of all the anti-Castro plots in 1963, and he'd had his CIA special affairs staff keeping tabs on a fellow named Lee Harvey Oswald. A few days before the break-in to Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office, the CIA called John Ehrlichman to say that their own assistance to Hunt was being terminated. Ehrlichman says he hadn't realized the CIA was aiding Hunt in the first place. Hunt told Ehrlichman that the latest operation was a failure. The Ellsberg dossier had not been found, even though one of the Cuban exiles involved in that break-in remembered photographing the psychiatrist's notes on Ellsberg. The film, taken by the Minock spy camera, was passed along to Hunt, who apparently turned it over as part of his regular deliveries to Richard Helms at CIA. This tells me that Hunt was misleading the White House at the same time that he was still playing ball with the agency. Soon after this, Nixon renewed his pursuit of the CIA's records. He sent an order to Ehrlichman, "Tell Helms to fork over the full file on the Bay of Pigs or else." So Ehrlichman went to see Helms twice within 4 days. At the second meeting, Helms asked to see Nixon privately once again. A transcript of their tape-recorded session in the Oval Office on October 8, 1971, was released by the National Archives in 2000. Would somebody tell me why a potential bombshell like this had to wait 30 years for us to know about, after all of the participants are dead? Before Helms came into the room, Ehrlichman briefed Nixon on the CIA director's latest excuse for not turning over the documents. Helms said that his relationship with past presidents had been such that he would not feel comfortable about releasing some of this very, very dirty linen to anyone without first talking it through with you, because he was sure that when you become a former president, you would want to feel that whoever was at the agency was protecting your interests in a similar fashion. This is incredibly dirty linen. Ehrlichman then continued, Helms is scared to death of this guy Hunt that we got working for us, because he knows where a lot of the bodies are buried. And Helms is a bureaucrat first, and he's protecting that bureau. When Helms arrived, Nixon pounded his desk and shouted, The president needs to know everything. The real thing you need to have from me is this assurance. I am not going to embarrass the CIA, because it's certainly important. Second, I believe in dirty tricks. Ehrlichman's notes quote Nixon as saying to Helms, Purpose of request for documents must be fully advised in order to know what to duck. Won't hurt agency, nor attack predecessor. Helms, at least pretending to be contrite, responded, I regard myself, you know, really as working entirely for you, and everything I've got is yours. He held up a file folder and continued, Should I turn this over to John? Ehrlichman. Nixon said, Let me see. It was a slim report by a Marine colonel who'd been assisting the CIA during the Bay of Pigs planning. In his memoirs, Nixon would complain that what Helms gave him was incomplete. The CIA protects itself, even from presidents. The day after the meeting with Helms, Ehrlichman sent a staffer to Las Vegas for a 4-hour chat with Hank Greenspun. It wasn't long after that when Hunt and his team of Cuban exiles began their discussions about burglarizing Greenspun's safe. The CIA's Office of Security already had 16 agents shadowing columnist Jack Anderson, who then was invited by Helms to a long lunch. Ostensibly, Helms wanted to try to dissuade Anderson from publishing certain sensitive classified material in his forthcoming book. A week after that, Hunt and G. Gordon Liddy started drawing up plans to neutralize Anderson. The CIA Office of Security was using another retired agent, James McCord, to keep tabs on the columnist. McCord also began working part-time at the White House for the CREEP, Committee to Re-Elect the President. Nixon would be gone when, in 1975, the CIA admitted to Congress its practice of detailing CIA employees to the White House and various government agencies, including intimate components of the Office of the President. And we thought double agents only worked against foreign elements. Hunt and McCord had been acquainted since the mid-50s, although Hunt lied under oath that they didn't meet until April 1972. McCord, according to the New York Times, was believed to have played a role in the abortive Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba in 1961. The CIA denied that, but recently released documents show that in early 1961, James McCord and David Atlee Phillips launched a domestic operation against the FPCC. That's the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, the same organization that Oswald suddenly joined in 1962. And David Phillips was involved not only in the anti-Castro plots, but also is said to have met with Oswald in Dallas in the summer of 63. Early in 1972, Hunt's Plumbers and McCord's CREEP security unit had merged into the Gemstone Plan, a wide-ranging series of illegal White House-based projects. Then, sometime on the night of May 1st to 2nd, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover died in his sleep. Nixon's Attorney General Richard Kleindienst immediately ordered Hoover's office sealed. Then the search for Hoover's secret files began. His personal secretary, Helen Gandy, later told Congress she destroyed many files marked personal at his home over the next few weeks. At Hunt's urgent request, Bernard Barker brought the Miami crew of Cuban exiles to Washington, where they made plans to break into Hoover's residence. But what happened to Hoover's trove remains unknown to this day. Around this same time, in a conversation about the shooting that paralyzed Alabama Governor George Wallace, Nixon suddenly flashed back to the Kennedy assassination and called the Warren Commission the greatest hoax that has ever been perpetrated. Somebody might have been able to ask what the president meant by that, except the tape transcript wasn't released by the National Archives until 2002. Meantime, plans for a break-in to Lawrence O'Brien's office at Democratic National Committee headquarters moved ahead. One of the burglars, Frank Sturgis, said Hunt told him they were looking for a thick secret memorandum from the Castro government addressed confidentially to the Democrats, a long detailed listing of the various attempts made to assassinate the Castro brothers. The burglars were also coached to look for anything that had to do with Howard Hughes. On the night of June 17th, five men, all using aliases, were caught red-handed inside the Watergate complex. McCord, the White House's security chief, was booked at the jail along with Sturgis, Barker, Eugenio Martinez, and Virgilio Gonzalez. Hunt's name was in two of the burglars' address books, and his link to the operation became known within 24 hours. He quickly left Washington. In later years, evidence came to light that McCord had likely botched the break-in intentionally. First, he went back and retaped a garage-level door, which served as a telltale sign to the cops. McCord claimed to have removed the tape from all the doors, but actually several had been taped to stay unlocked. A few days later, all of McCord's papers were destroyed in a fire at his home, while a CIA contract agent stood by. Hunt made a whole series of mistakes, too, surrounding the Watergate burglary. Nixon, in his memoirs, suggested, referring to the break-in to Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office, that Hunt could have been a double agent who purposely blew the operation. There was also the matter of a $25,000 cashier's check that had been deposited into the bank account of a Miami real estate company owned by burglar Barker. This check, laundered through a fundraiser for the committee to re-elect the president, was the first link connecting the burglars to the creep, after Carl Bernstein of the Washington Post broke the story about it. Well, it turns out the check wasn't deposited by the creep. Liddy had given it to Hunt, who'd put it in Barker's account. So money that should have stayed anonymous and untraceable then became an easy mark to track. 3 days after the break-in, Nixon called Haldeman, instructing him to tell Ehrlichman this whole group of Cubans is tied to the Bay of Pigs. Ehrlichman will know what I mean. 6 days after the break-in, Hunt sent word through his boss at the Mullen Company that he wanted the White House to find him a lawyer. That same day, June 23rd, came Nixon's smoking gun conversation with Haldeman. When the presidential tape was released 2 years later, it became proof positive that Nixon had been involved in trying to cover up the burglary, and this led to his resigning before he could be impeached. "Well, we protected Helms from one hell of a lot of things," Nixon said on the tape, referring to the CIA director. Of course, this Hunt, that will uncover a lot of things. You open that scab, there's a hell of a lot of things, and we just feel that it would be very detrimental to have this thing go any further. This involves these Cubans, Hunt, and a lot of hanky-panky that we have nothing to do with ourselves. On details of the Watergate burglary, the president seemed confused. Who ordered it? He asked Haldeman. Who was so stupid as to have given a creep check for $25,000 to Barker? Then Nixon instructed his aide to tell Helms, "The president's belief is that this is going to open the whole Bay of Pigs thing up again, and, these people are playing for keeps, and that they should call the FBI in, and we feel that we wish for the country Don't go any further into this case, period. That afternoon, Helms and his deputy were summoned to the White House, where Haldeman passed on Nixon's message. In his memoirs, Haldeman wrote, "Turmoil in the room, Helms gripping the arms of his chair, leaning forward and shouting, 'The Bay of Pigs has nothing to do with this. I have no concern about the Bay of Pigs.' Silence. I just sat there. I was absolutely shocked by Helms's violent reaction. Haldeman reported back to Nixon that there was no problem. Any leads that would be harmful to the CIA and harmful to the government would be ignored." The White House tape of that conversation trails off cryptically, full of unintelligible remarks. "Dulles knew," Nixon said, referring to Alan Dulles, CIA director at the time of the Bay of Pigs, who was fired by JFK and later named by LBJ to the Warren Commission. "Dulles told me. I know. I mean, unintelligible. Had the telephone call. Remember I had a call put in, Dulles just blandly said, and knew why. Unintelligible. Covert operation? Do anything else? Unintelligible." Those unintelligibles might have told us something, wouldn't you guess? The next day, 7 days now since the Watergate burglar's arrest, on the tapes Nixon made some more unintelligible remarks about Hale Boggs, the Louisiana congressman who had been another member of the Warren Commission and a dissenter to its conclusion that Oswald acted alone. A few weeks after whatever Nixon said about him, Boggs died in the crash of a light aircraft over Alaska. Some suspected sabotage. The Los Angeles Star, November 22, 1973, reported that Boggs had startling revelations on Watergate and the assassination of President Kennedy. The Mullen Company's man in Washington, Robert Bennett, met with his CIA case officer, Martin Lukoski, in a Washington cafeteria. Lukoski's memo was considered so sensitive that he hand-carried it to Helms, saying Bennett had steered reporters at the Washington Post and Star away from pursuing a coup d'état-type scenario that would tie the CIA into a Watergate conspiracy. Bennett later admitted feeding stories to Bob Woodward at the Post, with the understanding that there be no attribution. It's yet another black mark against our media that the Post chose not to examine potential CIA complicity to any extent, despite the fact that every one of the plumbers had a clear-cut CIA connection. 11 days after Hunt was arrested, the FBI's acting director, L. Patrick Gray, was summoned to the White House and instructed by Ehrlichman to deep-six the files from Hunt's personal safe. Gray recalled being told that the files were political dynamite and clearly should not see the light of day. Gray said he took the material home and burned it in his fireplace. Hunt began to threaten the White House with public disclosure of his other secret activities unless he was paid off. The House Banking Committee was starting to look into the Watergate break-in, so Nixon brought up the name of Congressman Gerald Ford. "Jerry has really got to lead on this," Nixon said. "I think Ehrlichman should talk to him. He's got to know it comes from the top." Not long after that, the banking committee voted against issuing subpoenas concerning the break-in. Why Ford? Almost a decade earlier, it was Nixon who recommended to President Johnson that Ford be put on the Warren Commission. There, Ford served as the FBI's informant about what the commission was up to. This was confirmed long afterward in an FBI memo stating, "Ford indicated he would keep me thoroughly advised as to the activities of the commission. He stated that would have to be done on a confidential basis, however, he thought it had to be done." We also have learned from some handwritten notes of Ford's produced by the Assassination Records Review Board, that he changed one of the most significant findings in the Warren report. A first draft had said that the bullet had entered his JFK's back at a point slightly below the shoulder to the right of the spine. Whoops! That trajectory meant there was no way for that bullet to emerge from Kennedy's neck and then somehow hit Governor Connally. No more magic bullet. So Ford urged the commission to change the description and put the wound up higher. Ford wanted it to read, "A bullet had entered the back of his neck slightly to the right of the spine." The commission went with that, except it added two words, "the base of the back of his neck." So Ford had always been counted on to help out in critical situations. Later, after Spiro Agnew was forced to resign, Nixon named Ford as his vice president. And after Nixon resigned, President Ford proceeded to grant a pardon to Nixon, so he couldn't be pursued by the courts for obstruction of justice and whatever else. In the fall of 1972, Howard Hunt's wife Dorothy paid a call on Cuban exile leader Manuel Artemé. He was Hunt's friend, dating back to Bay of Pigs days. Mrs. Hunt came to assure Artemé that the Cubans imprisoned for the break-in would not endure difficulties in Washington and that money would be delivered to a legal aid fund. Artemé, we know today, was directly connected to the Cuban exiles being used in the anti-Castro plots and also to mobsters like Traficante. Not long after that meeting, Dorothy Hunt died in the crash of a United Airlines plane as it made a final approach to Chicago's Midway Airport. More than $10,000 was found on her body. Sabotage of the plane was raised, but never proven. A week after the crash, FBI agents combed through Hunt's residence looking for stash documents, but apparently found nothing. Nixon and Colson met to discuss the possibility of granting clemency to Hunt. During this same time frame, Helms instructed McCord to send a letter to his friend Jack Caulfield, a New York detective who'd been engaged by the Plumbers, and who in 1964 had looked into Oswald's possible Cuban connections for the FBI. McCord wrote to Caulfield, "Sorry to have to write you this letter, but felt you had to know. If Helms goes, and if the WG, Watergate, operation is laid at the CIA's feet, where it does not belong, every tree in the forest will fall. It will be a scorched desert. The whole matter is at the precipice right now. Just pass the message that if they want it to blow, they are on exactly the right course. I'm sorry that you will get hurt in the fallout." Nixon had summoned Helms to Camp David, where no taping system existed, and told him to expect to be replaced as CIA director. When Helms then received a request from the Senate to preserve any Watergate-related documents, he set out to destroy all of his private files, some 4,000 to 5,000 pages. Helms also ordered shredded almost the entire record of the CIA's efforts to control human behavior, MK Ultra, in the 50s and early 60s. Then he accepted Nixon's offer to become the American ambassador to Iran. Almost simultaneously with Helms's departure from the CIA, someone broke into the Washington office of the lawyer who'd represented both Mayhew and Roselli and made off with all those files. The lawyer, Edward P. Morgan, said, "Watergate was pernicious, but the biggest cover-up of my lifetime was the assassination of JFK. To the CIA, this was something of life and death. If it could ever be established that their actions against Castro ended up killing Kennedy, the truth of the whole thing is still a hell of a long way from being out." Following the Watergate trail into early 1973, came the bombshell that ignited the Senate hearings, a letter from McCord to Judge John Sirica. McCord wrote, "The Watergate operation was not a CIA operation. The Cubans may have been misled by others into believing that it was a CIA operation. I know for a fact that it was not." Why did McCord feel compelled to state this? Maybe because this was just the latest gambit in his long history of cover-ups on behalf of the CIA. McCord's attorney happened to be Bernard Fensterwall, Jr., who had a private committee to investigate assassinations, CTIA, and had once represented James Earl Ray. In exchange for helping McCord post bond, the papers said, it was understood, however, that McCord agreed to help Fensterwald in some of his research at a later date. McCord's letter kicked off a chain of events that eventually led to the resignations and indictments of nearly Nixon's entire staff. And the links back to the JFK assassination just kept cropping up. After the infamous Saturday Night Massacre in 1973, where Nixon fired Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox, a Houston lawyer named Leon Jaworski was named to replace him. Jaworski had helped the Warren Commission check out a possible connection between Oswald and the CIA. That in itself was something of a conflict of interest, since Jaworski was also a board member of a CIA front company, the M.D. Anderson Foundation. When Jack Ruby made his anguished plea that the Warren Commission get him out of Texas and fly him to Washington if it wanted to learn the truth, only three people were present: Earl Warren, Gerald Ford, and Leon Jaworski. They didn't take him up on his offer. The overlap between the Warren Commission and Watergate legal staffs didn't stop with Jaworski. Arlen Specter, for a time a member of Nixon's defense team, was the originator of the magic bullet theory. Albert Jenner, minority counsel during the House impeachment proceedings, had been in charge of looking into conspiracy rumors for the Warren Commission. David Bellin, a junior counsel and the commission's staunchest defender through the years, would be President Ford's choice as executive director of the Rockefeller Commission, that was assigned to scrutinize the CIA's past domestic illegal operations. General Alexander Haig, who became Nixon's chief of staff through the final days, had been the Pentagon's chief assistant on all matters pertaining to Cuba in July 1963. In that capacity, Haig, along with Alexander Butterfield, who revealed the existence of the White House taping system to Senate investigators, had as a primary task the resettlement of the Bay of Pigs prisoners released by Castro, such as Artemé. As Charles Colson later told the story, Haig had called him to a meeting in January 1974 and said, "Well, if the president's going to be impeached, better he go down himself than take the whole intelligence apparatus with him." More than a decade later, I find it remarkable how many of the Watergate players are tied into the Kennedy assassination. They not only escaped justice the first time, but here they are back again. I wonder what else they did in between, what other damage to the country. In terms of all the burglarizing, you commit crimes because the end justifies the means, I guess. As long as you achieve the goal, the way you do it doesn't matter. One job only leads to the next. In 1974, there occurred six unsolved burglaries into Howard Hughes's offices in only 4 months. Two in Las Vegas, one in an L.A. suburb, one in New York. Another break-in occurred at the Mullen Company's Washington office. In most of these instances, no papers were reported taken. Then, someone made off with all of Hughes's handwritten memos hidden away in a block-long two-story building in Hollywood. A federal judge had just ordered some 500 of these memos to be turned over to Mayhew. At the same time, the Watergate Committee's staff had just begun looking into the Mayhew CIA mob exile connections from the early 60s. Soon, Nixon was out of there. He'd been cutting deals in politics his whole life, with a closet full of skeletons. Over the next couple years, a portion of the CIA's family jewels saw the light of day, as they did Roselli, Artemy, Giancana, Jimmy Hoffa, George de Moen Schilt, and more took whatever they knew about the assassination of JFK to their graves. McCord got out of prison, moved to Colorado, and refused all requests for interviews. As for Hunt, the man who spooked everybody, he died in January 2007 at the age of 88. His son, Howard St. John Hunt, then came forward with the story that his father had rejected an offer by rogue CIA agents to participate in the Kennedy assassination. Specifically, Hunt had named LBJ as the conspiracy's chief organizer. CIA conspirators supposedly included David Phillips, Cord Meyer, Bill Harvey, David Morales, and fellow Watergate burglar Frank Sturgis. All dead and gone, of course. The younger Hunt remembered his mother informing him on November 22, 1963, that Howard was on a business trip to Dallas that day. Before he died, Hunt allegedly told his son there was a French gunman firing from the grassy knoll. So did Howard Hunt come clean with a deathbed confession? Or was he blowing smoke till the end, continuing to spin a web of disinformation that foisted blame onto others? No mention of Helms, or his pal Artemy, or his Watergate co-conspirator McCord. I'm not one to give E. Howard Hunt the last word. This much I do know. Whatever hidden knowledge he was carrying, it scared the crap out of both Nixon and the CIA. Who took down who in the end? I'm placing my bet that Nixon was set up to take the fall because he was meddling too much in the CIA's business. Nixon's well-known penchant for paranoia may, in this instance, have gotten the better of him. He had shady dealings with so many people, from Howard Hughes to mobsters, it's hard to sort out which particular secrets he was trying to protect. But what I've tried to show, through the chronology of Watergate, is that there was a whole lot more to the story. This chapter exposes the underbelly of payback within the government. I've got something on you, so you should know better than to push too far into places I don't want you to go. In order to climb the ladder of the two political parties in our current system, you have to condone their corruption. I believe most people, when they initially start in politics, are good people. They come into the system wanting to do their job, to change things. But the longer you stay in the system, the more corrupt you become. The two parties, to me, are today no different than joining the Hell's Angels. Once an angel, always an angel. That's what holds true for Democrats or Republicans. Unless you separate from them and join a third-party movement, knowing that you've broken away and beaten the addiction. What should we do now? In an open-minded society, alternatives to the accepted version of events need room to be voiced, without being dismissed out of hand as fantasy. This is the lesson of Watergate for our time, where President Nixon may have been more a victim than an orchestrator. This story also leaves us to consider that there's more than one way to take down a precedent that surfaced again with the impeachment proceedings against President Clinton.